said, you know, we don't call it a climate change adaptation plan. We call it a survival plan.
Alaskans make the case for action at the climate talks in Paris. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, December 11th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, an Anchorage mom organizes a walk to honor her daughter who was nearly killed this fall.
We're going to put a face on violence and say that we're not going to stand for our innocent family and friends being gunned down anymore.
Tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wants to keep you safe from the invisible killer. Be safe this winter and always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This is a message from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. For more information, visit cpsc.gov. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Supporters of the Fairbanks Four rallied outside the state courthouse in Fairbanks today. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the protest was spurred by a proposed settlement in the long-contested case of the four Native men who claim they were wrongfully convicted of the 1997 murder of John Hartman.
The settlement proposed by attorneys representing the Fairbanks Four and the state of Alaska would free George Fries, Kevin Pease, and Eugene Vent. Marvin Roberts is already out on parole. The deal would also require the four men withdraw claims of innocence and not pursue compensation for wrongful conviction. Superior Court Judge Paul Lyle issued an order Thursday canceling a scheduled Friday hearing on the agreement, questioning the legality of freeing men the state maintains are guilty and wants the right to retry if new information becomes available about John Hartman's murder. Lyle's order does not outright reject the settlement, but gives attorneys 10 days to justify or alter it, noting the potential for clemency or pardon. Tanana Chiefs Conference Justice Task Force Chair Shirley Lee spoke against the proposed settlement at a Friday rally for the Fairbanks Four.
But we're so desperate to see them out that we're willing to accept things we shouldn't have to.
Of course they're going to take that deal. They're dreaming of being at home where it's warm with their family, where they're loved and safe.
Fairbanks Four supporter Misty Nikolai went on to challenge Alaska Governor Bill Walker to step forward and free the men. The current situation follows a hearing this fall on post-conviction relief petitions filed by the Fairbanks Four. The five-week proceeding heard testimony from dozens of witnesses, including a former Fairbanks man jailed for unrelated killings who claims a high school friend, not the Fairbanks Four, murdered Hartman. Judge Lyle has anticipated taking more than 6 months to review evidence before issuing a ruling in the case. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Representatives from nearly every nation are hammering out the final details of a global climate change agreement in Paris. Negotiations are continuing through the night with the final agreement expected tomorrow. Several Alaskans are there, and APRN's Rachel Waldholt spoke to a few of them about why they made the trip.
Isa Sinek is 18. He's from Shishmaref. And during his time in Paris, he's been interviewed by, it feels like, just about every major news outlet in the world.
From National Geographic, from CNN, and tomorrow I'll be in an interview from Al Jazeera.
Sinek is one of several Alaskans who traveled to Paris, where they were greeted as messengers from the front lines of climate change. But there's also another predictable reaction.
This old lady, French lady, asked where I was from, and I said, I'm from Alaska, and like her eyes just bulged out of her head.
It was a three-day trip from Shishmaref to Anchorage to Minneapolis and finally to Paris. Sinek went as a youth ambassador for the Arctic Council and a representative for the Sierra Club and the Indigenous Environmental Network. He says he went to tell world leaders his stories from home, how his barrier island is losing ground to the sea, how the ice forms later in the year, delaying hunting, and how, for the first time in memory, he says, they've had rain in the winter. Sinek hoped to add urgency to the talks.
I know that they're doing their best in those meetings, but I feel like it's what they're talking about won't be into play for the next few decades, and we need something done right now because 20, 25 years, Shishmaref will be underwater.
Maya Lukin is no stranger to press coverage either. The Kotzebue City Council member was mayor when President Obama visited this fall, bringing with him a global spotlight. She was invited to Paris by the State Department and spoke on a panel with Interior Secretary Sally Jewell about what's happening in her region.
I said, you know, we don't call it a climate change adaptation plan. We call it a survival plan.
Lukin says it was encouraging to be able to tell her story to so many people and fascinating to hear how communities from the Marshall Islands to Scandinavia are coping with climate change. But every once in a while, she says, someone would ask, well, why do you live there? Why not just move?
It's kind of difficult to stay diplomatic when somebody asks you why is your life important? Because that's really what they're saying.
Princess Dajirai Johnson works with the environmental group Red Oil. Alaska is warming faster than most of the world, but she hopes the state can be a leader in a different way. With its far-flung communities and often challenging environment, she thinks Alaska can become a laboratory for the kinds of alternative energy, collaboration, and ingenuity that will be needed to cope with climate change.
Certainly in Alaska, I feel like we have the opportunity right now to really be a model for what is possible.
And that's the goal all three Alaskans say they are bringing home from Paris. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholz in Anchorage.
With the proposed Donlin Gold Mine moving forward, the city of Bethel is looking at transforming into an organized borough. At this week's meeting, Bethel City Council voted to give City Manager Ann Capella the go-ahead into exploring the process. Capella said, as a borough, Bethel would have greater control over land use and could tax Donlin.
The city of Bethel will have many, many of the impacts of this industry with no financial benefits. And there is no mechanism for the city currently at this time to go and make them come to the table.
Last month, Donlin Gold released its environmental impact statement. According to the document, Capella said if anything goes awry, the city can't hold the mining company accountable or extract impact fees, something the city could change as a borough. One of those impacts, Capella predicts, will be on Bethel's port and the Kuskokwim River. Capella says Donlin Gold plans to park a sea barge near Bethel and run at least two river barges a day along the waterway.
And by the way, they propose that nothing will ever happen, no spills will take place, and if it does, they'll call the National Guard. There is no contingency for emergency management.
As a borough, Bethel would have more leverage holding Donlin Gold responsible if damages occurred, creating demands for emergency mitigation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a wallet lost on a mountain 40 years ago finds its way back to its owner.
I must have lost my wallet the very first time I went hunting, probably slipped out of my wool pants at the time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Alaska Congressman Don Young doesn't think much of the proposal to bar people on the no-fly list from buying guns.
Those who are talking about what they're doing is against the Constitution, and I will fight to my dying breath to make sure that we have the ability to retain the Second Amendment.
President Obama pitched the idea last week from the Oval Office as a matter of common sense, but Young said in a speech on the House floor the no-fly list doesn't just include terrorists.
I personally, myself, have been on the fly list. It took me 6 months to get off of it. They didn't tell me who put me on it, why I was put on it, and what was the result from. 6 months.
The incident dates back to 2004, when Young says he was questioned before boarding a flight because his name was similar to a suspected bad guy. Young says the FBI is already notified when someone on the list tries to buy a gun.
Yes, I am an NRA board member. But to have people say the terrorists are running around buying guns is outright lie.
The director of the FBI said this week that the background checks required for guns sold at stores do give the agency a chance to stop a sale, but he said a buyer's name on the no-fly list isn't a sufficient reason. A few years ago, the Government Accountability Office found that most terrorist watch list suspects who undergo the background check are cleared to buy firearms. At the end of October, 19-year-old Kaya DeLaverne was shot in the head by a new acquaintance. Incredibly, she survived. Now her mother, Shalan Schreifels, is speaking out against gun violence. She's organizing an orange walk in Anchorage. That's part of a larger national movement to raise awareness of gun violence in honor of the 2012 shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary. Schreifels spoke with KSKA's Ann Hillman about what happened to DeLaverne on October 23rd. She was hanging out with a man named Connor when his best friend Christian burst into the house and started shooting.
Kaya was sitting in the upstairs bedroom. They were getting ready to watch a movie, and he ran upstairs, found her sitting on the bed, and shot her point blank in the face. And then he left, and she did call 911 from her phone, but they weren't able to help her because they didn't know where she was, because she didn't know the address to the house where she was at. So she didn't want to go downstairs because she was afraid he was still in the house. So she jumped out the second story window and actually saw him exit the house after she had jumped out and saw him drive away. Thankfully, he didn't see her. And then she got up and ran out to the road at 5th and N Street and started to try and flag down some vehicles to help her. And multiple vehicles passed her by without stopping. And finally, one person did stop, and they, you know, determined that she needed help and got her in the car, called 911, and sat there with her and held her and, you know, kept her safe until the police were able to come.
In the first initial weeks, I'm sure you were mostly just thinking about your daughter, but how did it make you think about gun violence differently?
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, obviously there was a lot of shock, but just that feeling of this is wrong. I should not have had to worry sending my child to college and her first semester of university. I'd been in Anchorage in September, so I'd seen her just 6 weeks before, moved her into her dorm, and it was just seemed so unreal that this could happen. And the more I found out about Christian on his Facebook page, he's glorifying guns and has so many pictures and videos of himself shooting, you know, high-powered assault rifles. And I just kept thinking, thank goodness it wasn't worse. Thankfully, she survived, and she's making a recovery now and should be able to make a full recovery. But obviously, that was a life-changing moment for me. And this is not the first time that I've been affected by gun violence in my life. I've lost two very close family members and multiple friends. And I grew up in Mountain View, and shootings were just kind of almost a daily occurrence. And I thought it was normal, but 2 years ago, I moved to Japan, and it took me about 2-3 months to realize that I wasn't living in fear when I was walking around anymore. It was just kind of a big wake-up moment for me, in that gun violence is not a way of life everywhere.
What are you hoping the effects of the Orange Walk will be? What are you hoping it will change?
My big thing with the Orange Walk is I'm hoping that it can bring people together. And, you know, I myself am a gun owner, as well as most of all my friends and my family. And so I'm not against gun ownership or gun rights, so to say, but I am against people infringing on each our liberty and our feeling of safety in the community. And I want everybody to come together, gun owners, non-gun owners, all of us to come together and understand that we're in this together, and that we're going to put a a face on this on violence and say it's unacceptable that we're not going to stand for, you know, our innocent family and friends being gunned down anymore.
Shalann Schreifels is the mother of a gun violence survivor. She spoke with Ann Hillman. The Orange Walk will start at 9 a.m. on Saturday at the Delaney Park Strip in downtown Anchorage. Legislators, police officers, and behavioral health specialists are gathering this weekend in Juneau for a town hall discussion on heroin. They'll be focused on finding local solutions to help people suffering with addiction. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Michelle Morgan started Stop Heroin, Start Talking as a grassroots initiative, a homespun way to get the word out about what she saw happening in her community. Her organization recently partnered with the Juneau branch of the National Coalition on Alcohol and Drug Dependence.
We realized that what Juneau Stop Heroin was doing is exactly what NCAD wanted to start doing more of.
NCAD provides advocacy, education, and some clinical services. For Sunday's community meeting, Morgan invited Representative Sam Keto and Kathy Munoz to weigh in on topics about the Good Samaritan Law and Senate Bill 23.
All I did was email these people, and they responded and said, yes, I will do this. And that is a testament to how forward-thinking that Juneau is getting to be. It's great.
The Good Samaritan Law passed last year. It protects people reporting overdoses. Senate Bill 23 could prevent overdose deaths with a drug called naloxone. Another topic at the meeting will be the lack of treatment options for people who want to get clean. There's practically nowhere to clinically detox in Juneau.
We can arrest someone for using drugs, put them in jail immediately. But if we want to put them in treatment, which I think is fiscally and just for our future more responsible, we don't have beds.
City Manager Kim Kiefer has been looking into a program in Gloucester, Massachusetts that helps people get into treatment. She discovered it's about $50 to connect someone with services, $230 to incarcerate them. Gloucester is a small town of about 30,000, like Juneau. But there, people suffering with an addiction can go inside a police department and ask for help, then go into a detox program and long-term treatment.
So in the 6 months that they've been doing this, they've had over 300 people that have come in and said, I want to get clean.
Kiefer says she didn't know much about heroin addiction, but she's trying to learn more. That means reaching out to people in and outside of Juneau to find what's working. Gloucester is about an hour outside of Boston.
So I said, okay, if I was going to do this, what would your recommendations be? And they said the first thing you need to do is you need to inventory what we have in the community.
Which leads back to there being nearly no treatment options in Juneau. But over $800,000 of the city's social service funds is being funneled through the Juneau Community Foundation. The Hope Foundation is adding another $1 million for grants to look into these issues. For Morgan, the one who started the Stop Heroin, Start Talking program, the biggest hurdle has been changing attitudes about addiction. And she says that's included her own. 3 years ago, her sister died of a heroin overdose. She wrote in the obituary, she died of cancer.
My sister would have died this year. I would have said the truth. I would have said, you know, my sister Eva died after a long battle of addiction. And I would feel fine, but 3 years ago, we were ashamed. You know, we didn't want anyone to know or, smudge her reputation. But now people are looking at it more. It is a health crisis. And in that sense, that's the big change.
A change Morgan hopes continues as lawmakers consider bills in this next legislative session. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wants to keep you safe from the invisible killer. Be safe this winter and always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This is a message from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. For more information, visit cpsc.gov. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ann Hillman. This week on AK, Lost and Found. Late last summer, walking on a fresh rockfall on Harbor Mountain, KCAW's Chantal Kauf-Schultz found a wallet. It contained all the things you expect to find in a wallet, like bank cards and ID. The leather was wet from Southeast's damp climate, but still in good shape. The owner was glad to get it back, but he was not so easy to find. He dropped it on this trail 40 years ago. Cuff Schultz tells the story.
People lose things all the time. After a while, you just figure it's gone and it's not coming back. I'm right by the scree field on Harbor Mountain Trail, and I just found a wallet, not 2 feet off the trail, right next to this fresh rock slide. But there's something different about this wallet.
This is a really dirty wallet, you know, kind of wet and gross.
And I looked at the ID, and it says it's a University of Washington ID card, and it says 1975. After some scrubbing, I can read the name on the ID, Bruce Adair Warden Jr. So I bring the wallet back to town to try to find him. I call the University of Washington, and then I Google him. There's a number, but it's disconnected. That's when I turn to Facebook. I message the administrators for 12 Facebook groups in the town associated with the disconnected phone number and ask them if they can help me solve a mystery. 165 Facebook likes and 62 comments later, I have a working phone number for Bruce Warden.
Hi, is this Bruce?
Yeah, hi, this is Bruce Warden.
Warden has already gotten a call from his sister and several friends about the Facebook post, telling him that some lady in Alaska has his wallet.
I was floored when I heard about that, like a needle in the haystack.
The first thing Warden wants to know is what he looks like in the picture.
Beard and a mustache and long hair.
Yeah, I got rid of that. You know, it was the 70s. Having been in the military where you can't keep your hairline was something that I wanted to do.
Originally from Washington, Warden went to college in Chicago and then was drafted into the Army's language school. When he came back from Vietnam, he finished his teaching degree at the University of Washington, where he received the ID that I found. Then he went looking for adventure in Alaska.
Because I remember getting off the plane in Sitka, April 13th, 1975, and it was snowing.
Warden fell in love with Sitka and ended up staying for 17 years.
If you're an outdoors person, you'd think you just stepped off the plane and landed in paradise.
Warden met his wife, Kathy, and raised his family in Sitka. He spent his days working various jobs, including substitute teaching at Mount Edgecombe High School and transporting mail for Alaska Airlines. He went fishing in his boat, the Faithful, played on the baseball team for Ernie's Bar, and went hunting in the mountains.
I must have lost my wallet the very first time I went hunting because get up on top and then start walking back along the ridge. And it's kind of steep, so you sit down and you're leaning against the hillside. And I probably slipped out of my wool pants at the time.
Warden has since learned his lesson, and he makes sure I know it too.
If you bring a wallet, don't leave it in your pants, put it in your pack or something, you know, I mean, go on.
Warden eventually left Sitka with his family in 1992 and got back to teaching, both overseas and in the States. He visits now and again to see friends. His picture is still on the wall at Ernie's Bar.
A small photograph of a guy sitting at the table in Ernie's baseball outfits, and I'm the guy with the beard on.
Nowadays, Warden lives near Mount Rainier and spends much of his time helping out in his wife's classroom and spending time with his 5-year-old granddaughter, who wants to see the wallet too. He's still amazed that it was found.
Because there are places around Sitka that you feel confident you're out hunting, be in places that maybe no one's been for hundreds of years, if ever at all. So to me, it was a real coincidence.
And it was lucky for me. I'm around the same age that Warden was when he lost the wallet. It reminds me of this Regina Spektor song about finding a wallet where she calls the wallet a mystery novel, a holy relic.
I found a wallet. I found a wallet. Inside were pictures of your small family. You were so young, your hair dark brown.
Bruce Warden is no longer a mystery to me. Now I'm thinking about his journey and mine.
Sounds like a kindred spirit.
He tells me I should look into teaching overseas like he did, and reminds me to never go hiking alone.
What they say about Sitka is once you drink the water, you always come back.
Yeah, I think that'll be happening to me.
We've started writing postcards. I recently moved away from Sitka, but like Warden, I don't think I've really left. Reporting in Hillsborough, North Carolina, I'm Chantal Kauf-Schultz.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Donna Erickson, who lives in Unalakleet. She remembers learning TV and radio skills growing up in Barrow.
I
I was really interested in broadcasting, so I got a job at KBRW every summer, and I worked as a night disc jockey at the old KBRW radio station. And then I got picked up in high school by APRN to do stories from Barrow. I had to go out and write local stories in the village and edit them and produce them for what was going on back in the late 70s. There was a huge drug bust that went on, and many people were arrested for cocaine in 79. There was a young boy who was playing on the ice on an Eskimo game called Muvaharak or Madaharak, when you jump from iceberg to iceberg, and he went under the ice, and he was under the ice for 20 minutes, and then a guy by the name of Carl Hild rescued him and did CPR, and that boy came back to life. And that was a story that I did. I happened to be at the scene with a tape recorder and had sound bites of all of the drama, and it was quite a good story for APRN. There was a lady, Martha Aiken, who did the news in Inupiaq, and she always was training and tutoring us younger disc jockeys to read the news in Inupiaq, and we had to read it live, and she sat right with us and corrected us and taught us how to read correctly. She translated the news there from English into Inupiaq, and we read it, and I think the listeners really enjoyed it.
Donna Erickson grew up in Barrow and now lives in Unalakleet. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK. We had help this week from Chantal Kaufschultz, Zachariah Hughes, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rachel Waldholtz and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldholtz. Monica Goki is our web editor. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.